distribution. Well, you know, well, doing what we can. One money people mind that, hey, I'll tell you, brother, have to wait. All right, all right, all right. What is this constitution? Well, you know, they don't want to change your head. Institution, well, you know, better free your mind instead. Go kind, pick your chairman mouth, gonna make it anyhow. All right.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Shout Out for the Climate. Our future is a constitutional right. On Monday, October 29th at 11:30 a.m. at Terry Shrunk Plaza in Portland. Shout Out for Climate supports the young plaintiffs in the historic Juliana versus United States court case. The event will feature music, art, relationship, and momentum building for local youth interconnection and action. Again, that's Shout Out for the Climate. Our future is a constitutional right. On Monday, October 29th, 11:30 a.m. at Terry Shrunk Plaza, 431 Southwest Madison Street in Portland. More information can be found at KBOO.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Here to Stay, an artist book fair the weekend of November 2nd through 4th at Matter in Portland. Here to Stay is a celebration of publication as art. The opening will be Friday from 5 to 9, and weekend events include tea tasting, book fair, art exhibition, and more. Participants include Just Seeds Artist Cooperative, Signal Fire, Eberhardt Press, Works Progress Agency, and many other artists, writers, and activists. Again, that's Here to Stay, an artist book fair the weekend of November 2nd through 4th at Matter, 811 East Burnside Street, number 124 in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. This is KBOO Portland. And it's 9:02, time for The Radio Activist. Today, talking to author Joshua Hunt about his book, University of Nike, How Corporate Cash Brought American Higher Education. At 10 o'clock, Air Cascadia, 10:15, Flashpoints, 11 o'clock, we got the Recovery Zone today, welcoming environmental journalist Ben Goldfarb and Beaver Ambassador Stephen Marshall to discuss the role beavers can play in environmental restoration. Thanks for tuning in to KBOO this morning.
It is 9:03. You're listening to KBOO Community Radio, and this is The Radio Activist. Today, Joshua Hunt on his book, The University of Nike, How Corporate America Bought American Higher Education. It's a close look at the role played by Oregon billionaire Phil Knight at the University of Oregon in Eugene and around the state. Joshua is here live for this hour on the line with us. We're talking about corporate control over public resources. I'm Lisa Loving. I'm live in Studio 2 with my friend and compatriot, Suzanne LeGrand. Suzanne, thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks so much.
And we're going to take your calls later. The number's 503. 303-231-8187. And we have a few activist events coming up to share. You can call our engineer, Tammy, to add your social change event. Right, Tammy? Right now, we'll try to read it on the air. And again, that number is 503-231-8187. Thanks for tuning in. Joshua, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing great this morning. How are you guys?
Good.
Good. There's so much going on in the world. And I have to say, Joshua, your book kind of came out of the blue, even though it seems like a gigantic story that's been hiding in plain sight for many, many years. And I just, for our listeners, I want to read the 30-second explanation for this book that I read in the New York Times. It was really well done. More than ever, it's really important for Americans to closely examine the costs of abandoning public institutions and hand them over to corporate interests to save a few dollars on our tax bills. This is a case study of what happens when we do that. Spoiler alert, it ends badly. That's you, Joshua. Joshua, what's going on at the University of Oregon, and why should we care about it?
Well, first of all, you know, what's been one reason we should care about it is that what's going on at the University of Oregon is happening all across the nation at public schools, public universities, state schools. And it's sort of a microcosm of something that's happening more broadly, which is taxpayers giving up on these important public institutions and leaving them really susceptible to take over by corporate and private interests. You know, I gave a reading here in Eugene, where I'm at today, at a bookstore, and I talked about in one of my, you know, in some of my readings there, I talked a bit about the roots of this going all the way back to 1990 and the passage of Ballot Measure 5, which severely, you know, cut funding for not just higher education, but all public schools in Oregon, so that taxpayers could save a few bucks. And it wasn't, you know, it was like a lot of things. Measure 5 was championed and nurtured and pushed through by this small, dedicated group of really conservative anti-tax activists. And, you know, Oregonians, a lot of Oregonians will remember guys like Bill McIntyre and, you know, groups like Oregon Citizens United and groups like this.
Sizemore, I think, had a piece of that.
Yeah, and so, you know, and so that's how it starts, is people saying, oh, you know, let's save a little money on taxes. You know, these schools can get by with little less. And, you know, it turns out they can't. And when you strip away all their funding, they go looking for it elsewhere. And that's what happened at the University of Oregon, where the president of the University of Oregon at that time, from 1994 onward, this guy Dave Frohnmayer, a pretty big figure in the history of the state, former state legislature member, former attorney general. People who have seen the documentary Wild Wild Country will perhaps know him from his involvement with the Rajneeshi affair as Oregon's attorney general at that time. You know, this was a savvy, corporate-minded, you know, politically connected guy who, when his school was up against it and needed additional funding, he went, you know, straight for where the money was, which was Nike and Phil Knight. And he got it, and the school has been getting Knight's cash in increasing amounts ever since. And, you know, for a lot of people, for college sports fans especially, that might seem from afar like a good thing, because it's built a lot of big, shiny buildings on campus. It's built up this sports program. You know, it's gotten the Oregon Ducks brand, which was created by Nike, by the way, out there. But, you know, it's also led to increased tuition at the school. A lot of Oregon high school graduates are getting priced out of what used to be an affordable path to social upward mobility, you know, this in-state public university degree. And so it really is nothing less than a crisis. I mean, I've interviewed other university presidents who, you know, for instance, I interviewed Vin Vivel back when he was still the president up at Portland State, and he said, you know, it was becoming hard to imagine a future where students from, you know, lower class, working class, even lower middle class families would have a path to an affordable higher education, because, you know, students that maybe used to plan on going to the University of Oregon got priced out, and then maybe they were going to Portland State again, as I did as an undergraduate. And then he said, you know, that's sort of now people are getting priced out of Portland State too. So this funding problem is happening everywhere.
If you just tuned in, this is the Radio Activist. I'm Lisa. I'm here with my compatriot Suzanne. We are talking live on the phone right now with Joshua Hunt on his book, The University of Nike, How Corporate America Bought American Higher Education. Okay, so now you just put it on the table there, Joshua. A lot of people are listening right now and thinking, well, how could the rich guy's cash that he put on the table make everything more expensive for us? Can you explain those Rube Goldberg devices, basically, of how that money that guy is pumping out actually costs more for us? Because it blew my mind. Like, I had to read that part a couple times to even accept it.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, it's funny to imagine, but it turns out the guy who went to Stanford Business School and started up one of the, you know, most profitable apparel companies in the world knows a thing or two about getting the better end of the deal in everything he does. Phil Knight, in my reporting and my research, just doesn't come out on the losing end of the deal when he's putting his money on the table. That's just how it is. He's a smart and savvy business person, and so we'll use the new project at the University of Oregon as an example, the Knight Campus for Accelerating Scientific Impact. It's called, if you can wrap your head around that name and what that even means. It sounds like a Silicon Valley incubator of sorts. But okay, so when Phil Knight, when this was announced, and I talk a little bit about this in the book. When this was announced, it was announced all of a sudden as this generous gift from Phil Knight of $500 million for this huge new campus. The problem is that the campus costs $1 billion. So at the same time, Knight is handing you a check for $500 million, he's also handing you a bill for the other $500 million. And it becomes, you know, it's very difficult to raise $500 million, especially when, well, one challenge is simple. It's already called the Knight Campus for Accelerating Scientific Impact. So anyone else who gives, you know, say $100 million, $200 million, $300 million, whatever they give, they're not really getting recognized at the level that Phil Knight might be getting recognized. Maybe there are corporations who aren't so concerned about naming rights. They just want access to the research and stuff that goes on there. That's very problematic in a whole other way, because there are loopholes in our open records laws which allow for communications between, say, a university administrator or a university researcher and, for example, someone at a giant pharmaceutical corporation. They can keep their communications secret through a loophole that allows for keeping trade secrets private. And so, you know, say there's partnerships with pharmaceutical companies and they're talking about any number of illegal activities or unethical activities. Say they're talking about some study that they've done that this corporation funded, which shows that their medication has some harmful effects, and the researcher wants to publish it, and they're saying, no, we won't let you, we'll sue you, read your contract closely, it says that we can sue you if you publish that, you know, any research that's, you know, detrimental to our interests or something. And, you know, unless there's some whistleblower that comes out of the woodwork, the public might never know about that, because the public records requests that journalists often make to institutions like this would be denied under this loophole, and these public records would be exempt from public scrutiny. Going back to the money, you know, this becomes, well, going back to sort of both of these issues combined, the money and the problem of you know, what might go on, what kind of shady stuff might go on at a university campus like this that has these kinds of close corporate ties. Well, imagine you're a university president like Michael Schill, who is basically, this is going to be his legacy. You know, university presidents, it's a kind of profession these days that's pretty short-term in terms of its thinking. Basically, the blueprint is you plan on going in, building something nice, having your name associated with it, and then moving on to the next college for a bigger paycheck, you know, maybe 3, 4, 5-year plan. Well, that's working out very well for him if he can get this campus finished and on the right track. So it could either be his legacy or it could be this great failure weighing him down. And if you've raised $800 million, $700 million of the $1 billion that you need to finish building your legacy, what aren't you going to do to get that last $200 or $300 million? If some corporation comes to you and says, look, we've got this money, you've just got to agree to do this or that, you're in a pretty weak bargaining position, and I'd argue you're susceptible to making all kinds of deals that might not be in the best interest of your students or your faculty.
Because I think you gave us a good picture of kind of what the incentive is for a college president. But isn't there a board that is supposed to be fiscally responsible and also responsible to faculty and students as well as the career of a president? I mean, how does this work?
Well, I just want to add one more thing from your last question on the money before we move on to that, because another thing about this idea of Phil Knight handing you a bill at the same time that he's handing you this check for $500 million, you know, since in the couple of legislative sessions, since Michael Schill went around bragging to the press about how this is the biggest, most generous gift and all this, I mean, since then, he's basically begging the legislature to approve more state bonds, which will come with heavy interest payments, in order to pay off some of the remaining money that's owed on this project. And so in the end, what happens is corporations really get a bargain. Corporations like Nike, billionaires like Phil Knight, they get a bargain by investing, you know, maybe half or so of what it actually costs to do these big projects, and they get all the credit. And meanwhile, the public ends up footing part of the bill, as do the students at the University of Oregon who face rising tuition. Now, on the matter of you know, boards and oversight in this, there's been some changes since famously several years ago when Richard Larivière was president of the University of Oregon, he wanted this independent board for the University of Oregon. His wish came true in a broader sense. Instead of being one unified state board, you know, there are independent boards at these universities. And one big problem is, at a luncheon last week, I talked about my book with some people, and one guy said, well, this is why it's so important to have integrity and leadership. Mm-hmm. And I said, I'm sorry, I disagree with you. Integrity is fallible, and it's a gamble. You're gambling. I mean, you want to just gamble on whether or not the guy leading your company or your university has integrity enough to not do these terrible, corrupt things? I don't think so. What we need is oversight. Mm-hmm. We need good oversight, and we need good systems in place so that these boards can be effective, so that they're not always fighting against so that faculty at the University of Oregon aren't fighting against the administration as they routinely are. But most of all, there just needs to be transparency, and that's not happening at the University of Oregon, partly because they have zero respect for our open records laws. They do everything they can to obstruct bloggers, faculty, citizen journalists, and a regular daily newspaper and radio journalists from getting their hands on public records, on records that they really are the owners of.
Famously, and they run a great big journalism school. It's I think that might be irony. If you just tuned in, you're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Lisa. I'm here with Suzanne. This is the Radio Activist. We're live on the line with Joshua Hunt, his book, The University of Nike, How Corporate America Bought American Higher Education. This show's really dedicated to activism. I thought this was a good fit, though, for this show, because this is literally the side of activism that we're often, you know, trying to push up against. And this is a very radical book. It's a very dangerous book. It's a big book, too. There's a lot in here. It encompasses like personal relationships, the Frohnmayer family relationships with Nike. I don't know if we're even going to get into that, because I think other media outlets have covered it a lot. But Joshua's talking about the lack of a really bad Freedom of Information Act practices at the University of Oregon. There is a economics professor named Bill Harbaugh. His blog, UO Matters, he's been covering the finances of the University of Oregon for years, and they have punished him. They tried to rule that he wasn't a journalist, so that he couldn't have access to documents. The thing is, FOIA is for citizens. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I'm just putting that out. So coming back to our awesome new best friend, Joshua. Joshua, how did you get onto this story? Tell that.
Well, in a way, it has a lot to do with the obstruction of records at the University of Oregon. You know, I told the folks who came out to one of my readings the other day that in a way, you know, there's this one particular public relations guy named Tobin Klinger, who has a pretty bad reputation among local journalists here. He frustrates a lot of people. And I said, in a way, he's done a public service, because, you know, by obstructing my request for some fairly simple records that I had access to when I was writing these freelance stories for the New York Times back in the spring of 2014, he turned what should have been a newspaper article into a book. I mean, that's really where this book came from.
And what is the first thread you picked up, though? It wasn't about necessarily the finances or anything. Go ahead.
No, it was about in spring of 2014, I was freelancing for the New York Times in Portland, and just writing about whatever I could. And one day I woke up, and Willamette Week or one of the other local papers had posted something online about this police report that had been released by the Eugene Police Department, and it was this very graphic account of this University of Oregon freshman who told police that she had been sexually assaulted, she'd been raped by three of the school's basketball players. She'd told her father about the crime just hours after it happened. It happened late on a Saturday night, early on a Sunday morning. She told her father about it later that same Sunday, and he reported it directly to the campus police at the University of Oregon. And even though they knew about it within hours of the incident, instead of launching a big criminal or administrative investigation, instead of really focusing on those things, and instead of doing other things that federal law says they're supposed to do. There's a law called the Clery Act, which says that certain violent crimes are supposed to be, not only accounted for in an annual report, but logged in this thing called a Clery Log, which is public and which is supposed to be available at the campus public safety office. The police did not log the crime there, probably because, certainly because journalists check it regularly. So the campus police did not log the crime, and instead of investigating it thoroughly, they sent it up the chain to administrators, who decided to handle it as a public relations issue. They put the PR department people on developing a plan of action for what to do to make the school look better once the story did break, if it did break. And fast forward to 2 months later, 2 months after the assault was reported, is when this police report leaked. And I just was flabbergasted that this had been quiet for 2 whole months, partly because these players were allowed to stay with the team and continue playing as they progress through the NCAA championship.
The football team. The football team, yeah.
Basketball.
No, basketball. Basketball. There you go. Basketball. Thank you.
Basketball, yeah. And so, you know, I just...
Did the 2 months coincide with their with the end of the season?
What's that?
Did the 2 months that the report did not come out, did that coincide with the end of the basketball season?
It coincided with, yes, it coincided exactly with, I mean, you know, the incident was reported basically just before they entered this NCAA tournament play, this, you know, and so it was a big deal for them to make it that far that year. It had been a while since they'd, you know, made it that far in tournament play, and not only that, after, you know, along with a couple of these guys who have this sexual assault accusation hanging over their head as they're playing in this tournament, they progressed far enough to win the coach a bonus. The coach got a bonus, I think it was $40,000.
Wow. Anyway, keep going. Honestly, Joshua, this book is like a planet. There's so much in it. I mean, right. It's almost like all the issues that hit our millennial people that we love so much.
Just to clarify, so the campus had a legal obligation to report this as a crime, but they delayed it for 2 months in order to allow basketball players to progress and ultimately get cash bonuses for the coach. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and basically what happened is the Eugene Police Department launched their own investigation, which is how the only reason the police report came about at all is because the Eugene Police Department had their own investigation into this, but there's, you know, Title IX. This is one thing that Obama had to come out and make very clear. You guys might remember back in, you know, well, throughout Obama's second term, really, he made a few important efforts to try and get schools to do a better job to investigate and adjudicate cases of sexual assault on campus. And one of the things he did was to issue a report that basically said, just, you can no longer, for a long time, universities use this as an excuse, you know, that, oh, the police are investigating it, it's an active investigation, therefore we don't have to do anything, we'll just stand around. And Obama came out and said directly, that's not what Title IX says, that's not what the law says. The law says you should be investigating this even as the police are investigating. You should be investigating it as an administrative issue, and you should be doing all that you can to make sure that students are safe and are alerted for. So, for example, this should have been reported in the Clery log. It should have been there for everyone to see. There should have been alerts, you know, that going out that a crime of this nature had occurred on campus. I mean, you know, so that students could exercise more caution. You know, I mean, it's interesting to me that when it comes time for investigations and lawsuits and criminal charges, they always make it always sort of hurts the accuser if there's alcohol involved. Oh, there's alcohol involved. There's a party. It's confusing. When something like this happens and they have an opportunity to be proactive and say, you know, be careful out there if you're going to a party this weekend or next, you know, don't drink to excess, maybe don't go to parties in this area, this is happening out there, they don't take that opportunity at all, because taking that opportunity would mean taking responsibility. It would mean owning the fact that their institution isn't perfect. It would be a blemish on their brand, and their brand frankly, is more important to them than their students.
Hey, if you just tuned in, you're listening to KBOO Portland. This is the Radio Activist. We are talking, this is a really deep dive into Joshua Hunt's book about the University of Oregon, looking at the implications for higher education nationwide. And this is a very long, it's a very long journey that Joshua has been on. And he's talking about the 2014 rape case at the University of Oregon that really broke open a lot of issues nationally, I think, definitely statewide, about the lack of transparency at the University of Oregon. Another piece, of, as I said, this story about the UO, it's like a planet. I mean, you've got sexual violence, you've got corporate corruption, but remember this, our University of Oregon Police Department was a thing that was organized there. We didn't always have university police departments. This has been in the past 10 years. Portland State's police department just killed an African-American man. So the University of Oregon police, the campus police department, had its own other scandal going on also that was like they were harassing each other. So it's like there's even layers of the,
yeah,
the scandals that were coming out, which blows my mind. So Joshua, again, this is a long journey for you. How did you get from this unbelievable... By the way, if you remember this UO rape case, I'm going to read from the Register Guard, okay? This is from 5 years ago. A University of Oregon freshman who reported that she was raped by three basketball players last year settled her civil lawsuit against the university for $800,000 and a four-year full ride enrollment at the university. The settlement agreement provided by the University of Oregon assigned no blame and resolved none of the disputed facts in the case. UO President Michael Schill said in a statement to the campus that no coaches, administrators, or other university personnel acted wrongfully. That's how the case we were just talking about resolved, to the degree that it has resolved. $1 million.
And the basketball players.
And let's talk real brief. You know, let's talk real briefly about all the lack of blame that, you know, all the blameless people that Michael Schill is talking about there. Let's talk about some of the things that went on in the aftermath of this. I mean, the the president of the University of Oregon at that time, you know, left in shame with this huge you know, guy Godfredson, President Godfredson, left with this enormous severance package. And then a top administrator, Robin Holmes, goes out and, you know, once the story breaks in the press, she goes out and tells and tries to put a nice face on the University of Oregon as a place that really values. Part of their public relations strategy was to start using terms like survivor instead of victim, to start kind of co-opt the language of activism and support, and to use it to say, oh, well, we have all these resources for survivors. Robin Holmes, this administrator, top administrator, went in an interview with the Oregonian and said, we have counseling resources, and I really encourage, you know, survivors of sexual assault to reach out to us and get the counseling they need. And so this woman did that. She did just that. And what did the University of Oregon do? Well, the counseling center had employees, these top administrators, had people at the counseling center steal her private the private files and notes from her counseling session.
Unheard of. Unbelievable. This blew my...
So that they could use them against her in the event of this
case.
Lawsuit that they saw coming, because they knew they'd so mishandled this whole affair. And that's what they call blameless.
Right. Here, I want to, because Suzanne asked what happened to the basketball players. Okay, I this is something I pulled up from 2016. There were three young African-American men involved in that case, and they sued the University of Oregon. I'm not sure how what the resolution of the lawsuits were. All three players allege university officials violated their due process rights and ruined their chances at professional basketball careers. The suits assert the players were treated unfairly when they were issued long-term suspensions after Lane County prosecutors declined to prosecute them in connection with the off-campus incident. So, that's from the Register Guard in 2016. And if you just tuned in, you're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Lisa. I'm here with Suzanne. We're talking live on the phone with Joshua Hunt. His book, The University of Nike, How Corporate America Bought American Higher Education. We're skipping across sexual assault. We're skipping across corporate corruption, government corruption. Now we just sort of briefly delved into kind of profiling in a way, talking about what happened to these young basketball players. But Joshua, how did you get people to talk to you? When did you realize it was a bigger story? Because I'm drowning right now. I'm drowning in this whole story. It's so big.
Well, you know, I had some good luck along the way in terms of how the story developed. I mean, basically, I came here, as I said, as a freelancer for the New York Times, and just wrote a couple of short stories about the immediate fallout of this case, this accusation against these three basketball players. And, you know, I just had a ton of questions left over, and I really wondered, you know, what was behind this huge PR machine that seemed to be driving the University of Oregon. And the more I just sort of kept coming back because I thought there was more there. And the more I came back, the more people talked to me, and you know, eventually some of these people gave me documents or put me on the trail of other documents. I heard stories that were hard to believe, and I decided to, you know, even though some of them sounded like outrageous rumors, I just decided to trace them back to primary sources. And in the course of this, that spring I was waiting to find out whether I'd been accepted into an investigative journalism program at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. So eventually that spring, I was accepted into that program. And it's a one-year master's program for which you need to do a master's project, a year-long investigative project.
And this was it. I'm giggling because you didn't choose University of Oregon. I'm just kidding. Hey, Joshua, we have a caller. We've got Mitch on the phone. Mitch, what are you thinking about this morning?
Well, I'm very glad that you're exploring this very big story, and I almost hate to interrupt it, but when you talked about how FOIA, Freedom of Information Act, is designed for citizens, not necessarily for professional journalists, it's designed to make journalists out of citizens, that reminded me of my frustration, because I do an email newsletter called a Media Discussion List, the Lalo Studios Media Discussion List. And what I tried getting some conversation around back 6 years ago when UCLA accepted Michael Milken, the junk bond king's money, to open a business law center. and what I found since then, because I'm wondering, where are all the articles from the progressives, from the left, from people who talk about crony capitalism at even the Republican think tanks? Where are they weighing in on this online? Because I know the corporate media, news media is captured, but what I'm finding is I think that there is a Google algorithmic interference that is making it look like if you type in critiques of UCLA opening the Milken Institute for Business Law and Ethics at UCLA, and you type that in, 6 years since that institute opened at UCLA, there was one article by Mother Jones critiquing it. You'll find no listings of any critique. You'll only find the Milken Institute crowing about itself online if you search.
There's also Jim Harbaugh and the UO Matters blog.
Yeah.
But I definitely want to bring that back to Joshua, because this is like another question we had. Who's talking about this, and what kind of interviews are you doing on this tour? And I mean, are we imagining that more people should be talking about this issue and they're not?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's one of my big hopes is that this, I mean, like you said, there's sort of a world contained in this book. It's many things. It's a book about education in America. It's a book about corporate interference in public institutions. It's a book a little bit about sports and college athletics and big money in college athletics. But it's, you know, at its heart, it's a book about the true importance of public institutions and how easily corruptible, how corruptible they are, especially when they become defunded. And when it comes to public records, you know, as a journalist, it's a very personal, important subject to me, just because journalists rely so heavily on public records to do good work. But it's very true that, and it's worth reminding people that that you know, public records, that means the public, that means you, that means everyone has a right to those records, whether you're just a curious citizen or a blogger or a citizen journalist or a more traditional journalist at a newspaper or a radio station. And so it is very infuriating when someone who is a public servant goes out of their way to block public records from being scrutinized by the public, and that's absolutely what's happened at the University of Oregon. The opinion pages editor at the Oregonian asked me to write an op-ed on this issue, and I'm working on that now, and I hope it's I hope it helps get the word out there about the fact that, you know, we have these laws for a reason. They're very important. I mean, if we...
So, Joshua, can I ask a question along those lines?
Sure.
So you have done a great job of showing us why private corporations, what benefit it has to for them to buy public universities. But my question is, so what are the mechanisms in place, or what mechanisms should be in place to combat this corruption?
Yeah, what should we be doing, Josh?
Because it seems to me like, you know, supposedly universities have some accountability to the public, but that seems to have broken down. So I'm curious what you see as the things that could be strengthened to prevent this kind of corruption from continuing.
I mean, the biggest thing is transparency. You know, transparency, transparency, transparency. People, like I said, when people talk about, oh, we need to make sure our, you know, we have good leadership and all this stuff, that's all nonsense. We just, everyone, I mean, you know, Dave Frommeyer.
But how does transparency work in this situation? I mean, you've talked about, you have a president who is interested in making a career. Presumably a board that is, as you said, more interested in the brand than in the students.
Yeah, what can we do?
So how do we change this at a systemic level?
Yeah, if we could break it down a little bit more. Yeah.
Well, one thing that would help is to make sure that, and one thing that I will sort of call for in this Oregonian op-ed, is that we need to make sure there are punishments meted out when public institutions break open records laws, so that citizens actually can get their hands on public records, because it's hard to fix a problem if you don't know the full extent of the problem. And you know, some people have asked me, what do you think Nike or University of Oregon supporters will hate most about your book? And I tell them, maybe they'll be relieved. Maybe they'll open it up and read it and say, oh, good, he didn't find out about this or that.
Oh, wow.
I'm sure there's still more out there, and I hope local and regional journalists keep on these people and keep working on the story. So that's one thing, is just, like I said, really hammer them on their abuse of open records laws, so that we can know the full extent of the problem. Another thing is, you know, I was asked on OPB the other day, near the end of the interview, what was the solution to all this, and I didn't come up with a very good answer. I thought of one later that I've been telling people in my readings.
Okay.
And, you know, this book really began with people, with taxpayers abandoning an important public institution. I think the solution needs to begin with us taking responsibility for our public institutions, recognizing that they're important, supporting them with our tax dollars, electing officials who want to support them with our tax dollars, and also, crucially, making sure that corporations are paying their taxes. Because if a corporation is going to be supporting the university, the state university, where you live, it should be through tax dollars and not through some private fiefdom where they end up gaining control and influence that they shouldn't have.
Quickly,
another important thing is activism. I mean,
the labor unions have really been doing stuff, and you wrote about that a little bit. The plumbers and steam fitters, labor is there arguing, against these cover-ups of how Phil Knight is doing that construction. Because one of the things that Phil Knight was doing was he was ignoring laws about wages and stuff, right?
Yeah, I mean, Nike has this long, long history of, looking at a history of Nike's abuses of labor and human rights overseas at factories where its shoes were made was inspiring in a way because, I got to be reminded of and write about this great anti-sweatshop movement that gained a lot of steam in the throughout the 90s, really, and became the most successful sort of campus protest movement since the movement against apartheid. And it's been especially inspiring then to see this kind of resurgence of activism on the political scene. And I should say, I'm a journalist. I don't consider myself an activist per se, but the work that journalists and activists do is pretty closely linked and pretty complementary, I think. I think it's very, when people say this is a dark book, where do you see rays of hope? One of the biggest things that makes me hopeful is seeing all these young people out there successfully protesting against the NRA, I get emails all the time from all over the country from different chapters of the Democratic Socialists of America. I think that's amazing. I mean, imagine just a few years ago, try and imagine, an organization called the Democratic Socialists of America having political clout. And here we are, and they do. And I think it's wonderful that there are young people saying, we really want to fix some of the things that we feel have been messed up by past generations and hold these corporations.
Hey, I want to jump in here really quick and say, actually kind of what I hear you saying is, again, I mean, if you just tuned in, you're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Lisa. I'm here with Suzanne. We're on the phone with Josh. His book is The University of Nike, How Corporate America Bought American Higher Education. And so Suzanne put the pot on the table, like, what are we going to do about it? And so we started talking about how many different activist issues there are within these how these universities are operating that are problematic. And literally what I hear you saying, Josh, is like all these different movements are fighting that fight, which is pretty interesting. The people who are fighting against the sweatshop conditions. And this is a place where Phil Knight really gets hit. And I do want to say this because I was talking with Suzanne before the show started, and we were remembering that story from 2012 where the Oregon legislature approved a Nike tax deal in a one-day special session. Right. I'm going to read from Oregon Live in case you just moved here. Despite misgivings about a rushed sweetheart deal, the Oregon legislature approved a new law Friday that gives Nike greater tax security as the company plans a multi-million dollar expansion in the state. By the way, let's take a second and honor the difference between million and billion. Yeah. Anyway, so meeting in a special session called by Governor John Kitzhaber, legislators fussed and tinkered, but they passed the damn thing. I'm just saying, so I'm cranky about voting. I am very cranky. But when you're talking about the Oregon State Legislature literally holding their noses and kissing Nike's took us there, and there are certain things we can't say. So I'm just saying everything's on the table. I'm just saying that. What were you going to say, Suzanne?
Well, it's just interesting, again, because supposedly public officials do have some responsibility to the general public, but here's another situation where they basically rolled over. So what power do these private corporations have that allows them to completely circumvent political process and responsibility to other responsibilities to the public?
I would answer that because this is cracking me up. I had already, and then we're going to go to a caller. We have a caller. I had mentioned Bill Harbaugh and his really important blog called UO Matters. That's uomatters.com. And I was giggly because I saw where he actually made a post about Josh Hunt, about your appearance there in Eugene. And this is what he wrote. OPRs think out, OPB, I think is what he means. Think Out Loud has an interesting interview with author Josh Hunt. I suggest getting to Josh Hunt's at 7 p.m. Tuesday talk at Tsunami Books early before the lawyers steal all the good seats. So as we're talking about how does this work, what's protecting the system, I think that the word lawyer is big. And one thing that Joshua had mentioned, but he hasn't gone into very much detail, is when he's talking about the public relations force at the University of Oregon, I believe you were talking about like maybe more than 100 people?
I mean, so what I could document was more than 80.
Okay, there you go. Put close, a I lot. Mean, dozens and
that,
dozens.
That's more than 80 that just have, that's more than 80 that are explicitly public relations, marketing type staff. And that's more than the combined faculty of the departments of history, economics, and philosophy.
And who are paying all of their salaries?
We are. It's me and you, Suzanne, and maybe Josh. I'm not sure where Josh lives. That's totally cool. We're going to the caller. Who's the caller? Keen, what are you thinking about this morning?
Well, I'm thinking about the Freedom of Information Act, and I'd just like to, if people remember what's been going on with Portland Public Schools. And also, it's interesting that one of the longtime board members from Portland Public Schools, I think, is a vice president of Nike. And the third thing is that you have to pay a lot of money lots of times to get these Freedom of Information reports.
Right. Thank you.
So yeah.
That's it.
Thanks for bringing that up.
Thank you. I want to touch on that real briefly because there's an exemption that
there are hundreds of exemptions that the state of Oregon legislature has passed to keep people from getting access to records. And so there's another exemption that you're talking about. Go ahead.
There's a good exemption that's supposed to be in favor of public, of waiving these fees. You're supposed to be able to get these fees waived if they're in the public interest, right? If the issue is in the public interest. My reporting found that the head of the Office of Public Records at the University of Oregon didn't even know what the term public interest meant. She thought that it meant something that a lot of people were interested in, not, like a Justin Bieber concert as opposed to something that was a public good. And her subordinate, who was my source for this part of the story, had to explain to her what that even meant. So the person running this important department doesn't even understand the laws surrounding public records.
All right. Hey, I'm gonna jump in here again. We're beginning to think of, we have about six more minutes until the end of the show. We are live on the air with Joshua Hunt. His book, The University of Nike, How Corporate America Bought American Higher Education. But you're listening to The Radioactivist. So we need to take a few minutes right now and go through a handful of events that I've pulled up, and then we're going to go back to Joshua. It's going to take a few minutes, Joshua, but not very long. So
sure.
Because the purpose of the show, The Radioactivist, is to remind you listeners that actually you have the power. Really. So anyway, coming up tomorrow, Thursday, October 25th, Transgender, Non-Binary, and Intersex Solidarity, 5 to 7:30 p.m. at 5575 North Albina. When I looked it up, this was at PCC Cascade. So the president comes out. He's doing the stampede thing about people in the United States, all of us. And now we're wrapping around with our transgender, non-binary, and intersex communities. I love you so much. And that's tomorrow night at 5575 North Albina. Also tomorrow, Black Lives Matter at the Woodlawn Mic, right? The Woodlawn Mic, we've been talking about it on the show a couple times. It's this amazing new space, 1425 Northeast Deakin Street in Portland. This is an exclusive event for people of color. Everyone is welcome to attend. Just please yield to Black and Brown voices. This is tomorrow night, 6 to 9 p.m. at the Woodlawn Mic on Deakin. Also tomorrow night, the protest, working to understand the system. Our beloved pals at the Uprise Collective, we had them on the air just a couple weeks ago, are holding this event. It's going to be at the Unite Oregon offices on North Killingsworth. We will explore ways in which our current system has developed laws and policies. We will look at how laws get created today, how to use social stories to lobby for change, and how to engage in writing bills, right? That's the Uprise Collective on North Killingsworth tomorrow night, Monday, October 29th from 6 to 9 p.m. Dude, I'm saying, Sam Sachs and Noho Marchese from the No Hate Zone, Breaking Bread, Breaking Barriers Dinner. This is extremely radical. So Noho's is that Hawaiian restaurant on Northeast Fremont. People come together, they break bread with police officers. It's radical. It's the No Hate Zone, Breaking Bread, Breaking Barriers Dinner. I think they do this regularly. So this is Monday, October 29th at Noho's Hawaiian on Northeast Fremont Street. Yeah, check that out. Thursday, November 1st from 7 to 9 p.m., book discussion and reading with Dr. Adonia Lugo on bicycle race. Bikes for Humanity PDX, that's at 3366 Southeast Powell in Portland. Friday, November 16th, from 6 to 10:30 p.m., Muse and SWS Spaghetti Dinner Fundraiser for the Sunnyside Warming Shelter and Montevilla Emergency Warming Shelter. That's at the Sunnyside Community House. Come to their fundraiser to help low-income people Friday, November 16th. That's at 520 Southeast Yamhill Road. You know, if you are listening right now, you have an amazing event, go ahead and send it to lisa@kbu.fm. We'll read these events on the air. You're listening to KBOO, and I'm Lisa. My compatriot is Suzanne LeGrand. We're live on the phone right now with Joshua Hunt, his book, The University of Nike, How Corporate America Bought American Higher Education. Back to you, Joshua. Look, what's the most important thing, really, that you learned from this unbelievable dive, like almost to the molten center of the earth, I'm saying that, on this Nike stuff? What's the single most important thing for our listeners to take away from this big pile of information that you're serving?
Well, I think for activists, I think we're in these really troubling times where it's very easy to get cynical or feel a little bit overwhelmed. And I think for activists, one of the big reasons to go out and buy this book is because it proves that activism really works. I mean, there's this story that unfolds early in the book that shows just how effective protest and activism were in combating Nike's abuses of its workers overseas. And to the extent that Nike's labor practices are better today than they were then, Nike didn't do that because they thought it was the right thing to do. They did it because you guys forced them to. So I think that's as good a reason as any to read the book, is to be reminded of how effective activism and protesting can be when you work together. The anti-sweatshop movement was so effective because it was all these different groups. It was unions and union and labor activists working hand in hand with human rights activists. It was local and national and international cooperation. There was a huge amount of cooperation. It was so effective that when the winds changed and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan kind of shifted the direction of the protest and movement away from sweatshops and towards anti-war protesting, people were organized very quickly, in part because all these networks were in place.
Wow.
So that's an important lesson to take away from the book, and I think a hugely positive one.
All right. Joshua Hunt, wow, don't be a stranger. Come back. Come back and write the next book. Bring it back on these airwaves, all right? Just
thanks
saying.
So much.
Hey,
Thanks
to our guest, Joshua Hunt. His book is The University of Nike, How Corporate America Bought American Higher Education. Thanks to our engineer, Tammy Dean. Original music by Ms. Deluxe. The KBOO volunteer coordinator is Ani Haynes. Radical inclusion is her game. Contact her to be a volunteer at this station, volunteer@kbu.fm. The next volunteer orientation will be held Monday, December 3rd, 6 to 8 p.m. Right here, you could be behind this mic. We are radioactive. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned.
It's 9:59 here at KBOO Portland. Stay tuned at the top of the hour for Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And then at 11 o'clock, the Recovery Zone welcomes environmental journalist Ben Goldfarb and beaver ambassador Stephen Mershell to discuss the role beavers can play in environmental restoration. Remember that all of these KBOO programs are made possible by you members out there. If you're not one and you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on donate.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communication Act of 1934. And certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. This month, our meeting of the KBOO Board of Directors will be on Monday, October 29th from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. at Cider Riot at 807 Northeast Coote Street in Portland.